this week's program, a conversation with Christopher O'Reilly. The broadcaster and pianist is in recital at the Kimmel Center on Friday. Susan Lewis explores the Rosenbach Museum and Library, and Jason Pfeiffer has a behind-the-scenes look at the role of the stage manager. We'll hear from stage managers from the Arden, Wilma and Walnut Street theatres. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Christopher O'Reilly is probably best known as the host of the nationally syndicated radio program From the Top. The show that features the cream of young classical musicians can be heard each Saturday afternoon on WRTI. In addition to his duties as a radio host, O'Reilly is a classically trained pianist who continues to tour and perform regularly. But he isn't just playing Mozart, Debussy or Shostakovich. In recent years, O'Reilly has been applying his classical know-how to some unexpected repertoire. Originally used as a fill between segments on From the Top, and spurred by his fascination with the rock band Radiohead, O'Reilly's classical interpretations of that band's music, as well as songs by the recently deceased folk rocker Elliot Smith and the 1970s British singer-songwriter Nick Drake, have been met with both critical and commercial success. In these recordings and in companion recitals, O'Reilly bridges two very different audiences, and he'll be performing these piano rock arrangements at the Kimmel Center on Friday. So when we met, I first asked Christopher O'Reilly why a classical musician would want to interpret rock and pop music.
I don't really approach the arrangements that I do by virtue of any sort of overarching concept. The fact that I ended up doing not one but two Radiohead records of piano arrangements had more to do with the fact that that was just the music in my head, and I was listening to just about, you know, nothing but Radiohead. But at the same time, there were other songs that were really catching my imagination, and I was actually doing other arrangements around the same time as I was doing Radiohead, including Elliot Smith, and including, right at the very beginning of the whole process, Nick Drake. It's just a matter of what song I'm listening to hundreds of times and can't get away from. So it's never really a matter of a project. It's really a matter of just sort of a connection. With me, it's the same connection as it is for any of the classical repertoire that I play. I'm really quite compelled and drawn to particular sort of sensuous harmonic language that I feel is shared by people like Elliot Smith and Dmitri Shostakovich and Claude Debussy and Radiohead and Messiaen and various other people. That and also a sense of textural ingenuity. I've always been drawn to the music of Robert Schumann for the fact that, you know, even if he has hundreds of songs, each song has an accompaniment figure in the piano that is completely indelibly unique to that particular song. Likewise, with Radiohead, for instance, you don't have this sort of wall of sound kind of organization of musical structure. You have five members of the band, each of whom are contributing a particular thread to the overall texture. And that by itself suggests, you know, how one might go about devising a piano version of something like that. And it also gets me out of let's say, like a jazz musician would have certain physical habits at the piano. It draws me out of myself. You know, getting into, for instance, Nick Drake's guitar playing, there are certain patterns that he uses that if I'm trying to be true to them, makes my job easier in terms of, I don't know, making it, you know, unique to Nick Drake and not just a matter of me sort of jangling around with the patterns of my own hands. Similarly, with Elliott Smith's music, you have a widely diverse body of work between the studio versions of a song and, let's say, the 100 or so live versions of each song that Elliott wrote, and how he made choices, you know, from the studio version, which was largely self-produced with his material, to the solo live performances, in which case, well, you know, he's making choices. You know, what are the elements that are absolutely essential to the song, and so what choices has he made in that circumstance, and how should that affect the way I play it on the piano? Kinds of interesting sort of threads that sort of catch my ear and lead me into the song, and then the way through it is always a matter of editing and revision, and of course, you know, because it's not my material, it's my doing the best I can to make the other material come alive.
And is it the case that it's Chris O'Reilly using his language to express Nick Drake, or is Nick Drake teaching you a separate vernacular that in turn feeds into the other music that you play?
Well, I like to think that I'm trying, in the same way that I'm, you know, trying to approach a Beethoven concerto, trying to get inside what, you know, what was in Beethoven's mind, how he eventually, you know, wrote it down, makes a very large difference to me insofar as how far away I ever want to get from that kind of, you know, the law of the line, the law of the, you know, what's on the page. I'm you know, with Nick, I'm trying to understand what he was trying to do and get away from some of the extraneous things, you know, other playing styles that contributed to the album that may not really have been what he had in mind. And there are some pretty, you know, interesting examples of those kinds of disparities that make it really quite inspiring. So yeah, I don't really think of it in terms of doing it my way. It's just, you know, I guess the way that I hear things, the way that I try and emulate certain things that are unavailable to the piano, the way, for instance, you try and approximate the sound of the human voice. I give a large nod to Thelonious Monk in that regard, because a lot of what people refer to as wrong note playing, I try and imagine he was trying to emulate the voice. He was trying to emulate the plaintancy of the saxophone, etc. With Nick Drake, for instance, you know, one of the modes of authenticity that I'm most strict about is the way that he phrased. I mean, he was a remarkable musician in that he sort of was pigeonholed within the folk world. But at the same time, when you actually listen to his vocal phrasing, it's really straight out of the jazz tradition. And so that's an interesting juxtaposition within the style, this man almost singing to himself, but with an exuberance to the harmony and an exuberance to the rhythmic placement and the phrasing within the song that makes it, you know, unique, makes it Nick Drake.
Better set you pray today for the sky to blow away, or maybe stay.
But yeah, Riverman particularly, you know, speaks to the jazz sensibility, I think.
Gonna see the Riverman, gonna tell him all I can about the band. On feeling free.
With this wide expanse of interest and of knowledge in all types of musical forms that you have, is there ever a point when the piano becomes restricting? Have you ever thought about perhaps having a larger ensemble, maybe even think about conducting symphony orchestras, well, for instance.
For instance, well, I think the piano, you know, part of what I'm doing is sort of showing off the instrument, you know, because I think it is capable of just about anything. There have been certain specific examples, only one that I've really followed through on, where there was a Radiohead song that I really felt was the quintessential piano vocal Radiohead song, and that's a thing called Pyramid Song. And the one time I met Tom York, I said, you know, as much as that is a piano song, it's something that I could never imagine doing without the sound of his voice. And of course, very self-deprecating, he said, oh, you mean without me screwing it up, you know. But the thing was, I really did feel that the sustained quality of his voice in that song was something that I really couldn't approximate decently on the piano. And so as it happened, Christopher Rex, who's the principal cellist of the Atlanta Symphony, runs a couple of festivals down south and invited me to come play some Radiohead. And in the process, you know, speaking with the management, said, you know, do you think, you know, he was just getting to know Radiohead himself, as a matter of fact. Chris had never heard them before. And he said, you know, do you think Chris would come play some Radiohead? And maybe is there something that we'd collaborate on? And so indeed we did, you know, a version of Pyramid Song for cello and piano. And that took care of the sustained quality. There are some background string noises, sort of harmonic trills and things like that, that Chris was absolutely adept at transcribing and coming up with his own versions of. And so that was a very, very happy occasion. I tend to think, though, that what I'm doing is as little a reduction as possible. I'm trying to approximate the same kind of energy and the same kind of excitement that a full band version of any of the songs that I like maintain. But I haven't really felt compelled to make versions for, let's say, piano and orchestra, for instance, because I think historically, inherently, there's a sense of protagonist, antagonist, or protagonist and the Greek chorus, etc., in the same way that you have a Beethoven concerto, that I feel wouldn't serve a Radiohead song terribly well. Even songs like How to Disappear Completely, which have their sort of quarter tone string haze about them, I suppose could work quite well for piano and orchestra, but there again, the piano, the orchestra would just be mere background, and I like musicians, and I like them to feel engaged and like they're doing something important. And even though there are places, even in Rachmaninoff Concerti, where I really feel the composer had in mind for, you know, the strings merely to be a halo or an aura around the piano sound, I think in general there's enough material there to, you know, make it necessary to deal with a symphony orchestra. I feel with my own arrangements, I'm, you know, perhaps it's just selfishness on my part. I just want all the fun for myself. I don't know.
Are you ever thinking about the end user? Are you ever thinking, well, this is good for classical music listeners to you know, get down with the kids? Or it's also a good portal for youngsters to actually hear serious music?
Mm-hmm. Well, I do think that there is a left brain commonality between, you know, music of a certain complexity. And what's interesting and compelling about Radiohead's music is that it's not intellectually stimulating for its own sake. I mean, these are not guys sitting around saying, how can we revolutionize popular music? It's just that this is the music that they make. But I've introduced, you know, lots of classical music listeners to Radiohead's music, basically just because I believe in it in the same way that I believe in any of the, you know, quote-unquote serious music that I play all the time. And I think the proof is in the pudding. I mean, playing these pieces for the first time on the radio, on From the Top, as break pieces, I play them completely unpre-announced. So I'm really just living by the Duke Ellington adage, there are only two kinds of music, good music and bad music. This is stuff I believe in, and the audience has the responsibility to react not on the basis of prejudice, genre or otherwise, but on the basis of their own reaction, instantaneous, instinctive. So yeah, I think that I've brought a lot of classical music listeners to Radiohead, and I think I've brought a fair number of Radiohead listeners to classical music, at least in terms of curiosity, mm-hmm. At least in terms of, you know, having a common playlist in mind. You know, oh, I saw you, you know, I like your Radiohead stuff, and I saw you're playing a Mozart concerto in San Diego. I've always wanted to check him out. Why it takes me to, you know, introduce somebody to Mozart. I mean, that's a great responsibility, but it's I think, you know, basically they just, you know, have somebody in the business they can trust now.
Well, it's almost like you're the maker of their mixtape.
Maybe,
in a way.
Yeah.
It's been a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Great pleasure. Thanks, Jim.
Christopher O'Reilly. He performs his classical piano renditions of music by Nick Drake, Elliot Smith, and Radiohead, among others, at the Kimmel Center on Friday.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Some people call it the Rosenbach, but the brothers whose home is now a museum call themselves Rosenbach. Now, WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us on a visit to the Rosenbach Museum and Library.
In the middle of a quietly genteel residential block, a short walk from Rittenhouse Square, sits a repository of literary and art treasures known as the Rosenbach. Housed in the former home of its founders, the Rosenbach is a museum and library of fine things, but it is also a doorway into a world of stories of lives from both the past and the present literary and art world. The museum actually occupies two adjoining townhouses on Delancey Street, one at number 2008, now called the Sendak Building, where visitors enter, and the other at 2010, where the Rosenbach brothers lived. The inside of 2008 has a sleek museum feel and a gallery which houses the museum's collection of Maurice Sendak, a friend of the museum who now has over 10,000 drawings on deposit. The museum also has rotating exhibits which bring together individual pieces to tell larger stories, like the 50th anniversary exhibition called R is for Rosenbach, where over 150 of the nearly 350,000 objects in the collection were displayed whimsically in alphabetical order to explore unexpected connections, as Judy Gustin, curator and director of collections, explains.
In collections like this that are somewhat idiosyncratic in nature, the way a collector's mind, or a really good collector's mind, ends up working is that everything has a relationship to the next thing. If you took everything in the collection, threw it up in the air, and let it land, not literally, of course, anything that fell down next to the next thing would have a relationship to it if you're just willing to ask it to tell you what that was.
Telling stories through the association of objects continues in the family residence next door, where for the most part collections are unlabeled and tours are guided. But here, the story of the Rosenbachs begins. Arts and antiques dealer Philip and his younger brother, rare book dealer Abraham Simon Wolfe, known as the Doctor because of his PhD in English, owned the Rosenbach Company from 1903 to 1953, with shops in New York and Philadelphia. It was the rare book part of the business that made the name Rosenbach famous. During our tour, then Associate Director Michael Barsanti explained.
In the United States, there was something of a fad in book collecting in the 20s and 30s. And you also had economically a situation where you had some of the great families of Europe and of Britain in particular who were book rich and cash poor on one side of the Atlantic. And then here in the United States, you had industrialists who were cash rich and book hungry. And Rosenbach was able to buy from people in Europe some of the real great treasures in books and manuscripts in particular, and sell them to people like Henry Folger, whose collection later became the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C., the Widener family, whose collection became built as the Widener Library at Harvard.
Abraham died in 1952 and Philip in 53, and the museum and library opened a year later. Aside from an opportunity to get a look at the first book printed in the United States, or a comic book made by a boy who would grow up to write Alice in Wonderland, or the manuscripts of Chaucer, Dickens, and Joyce, just to name a few, a tour of the residence is a visit back into the lives of the Rosenbachs and those whose lives they touched. The first floor rooms are furnished to illustrate their tastes. Think 18th century gentlemen. The second floor is now being renovated to provide gallery space for changing exhibits. In May, a year-long retrospective on Maurice Sendak will open. The third floor houses a library with works purchased by the brothers. There is also space devoted to another friend of the museum, the 20th century poet Marianne Moore, whose living room is recreated with her personal effects in a room that bears uncanny resemblance to her own. In Dr. Rosenbach's library, the walls are lined with shelves filled with beautifully bound or boxed books and manuscripts, as well as related things which you wouldn't necessarily expect. Near the manuscript of Ulysses sits a plaster death mask of its author, which made its way from Joyce's face after his 1941 death to Delancey Street by way of Hollywood, as Barsanti explains.
John Huston directed a film version of Joyce's short story, The Dead. While he was doing that, he was presented with this death mask. John Huston then gave it to his son, and his son, not wanting to display it in his own house, heard about the Rosenbach as the place that had the Ulysses manuscript and gave it to the museum on a long-term loan, where it was here for many years. Huston decided to sell it, and the person who bought it from Tony Huston eventually decided to have it on display here as well, so that Joyce can be back together with his Ulysses manuscript on our shelves. It's certainly a very accurate presentation. It's really kind of, it's a little scary looking.
The museum has beautiful and rare objects and wonderful stories that go with them. Ultimately, though, the greatest strength of the Rosenbach today is the same as it was when its founders were alive. The ability to make human connections with people, with the artists and writers it has drawn into its world, from Lewis Carroll, Dickens, and Joyce, to Sendak and Marianne Moore, and with those of us who, like invited guests, step through its mahogany townhouse doors.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. A special exhibition on Maurice Sendak called Maurice Sendak's Really Rosie runs through March 9th at the Rosenbach. In May, a new year-long retrospective will open on the noted children's author and illustrator. Today at 2, the Rosenbach's composer-in-residence, jazz pianist Dave Burrell, will perform and discuss his music, Syllables of the Poetry of Marianne Moore. The work was inspired by the museum's holdings relating to the 20th century poet. When we go to the theatre, the action on stage is generally of most interest to us, but behind every show is a flurry of activity out of sight from the audience. Costume dressers, stagehands, lighting and soundboard operators all work together to support the work of the actors and ensure the show runs smoothly. And at the helm of all this is the stage manager. Now, as part of our continuing series on what it takes to bring theatre to life, WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer explores the role of the stage manager.
You might not even realize that they're there, perched behind or perhaps to the side of an audience. A stage manager runs the show from what might be thought of as the command center, giving the signal for each scene change, lighting transition, or sound effect.
Go.
Lights 8.5, standby sound E and Q light off. Lights 8, go.
Seated in a dimly lit booth overlooking an ardent theater audience in Philadelphia, Pat Sabato calls out cues over a radio headset. Sabato has been stage managing at the Arden for about 10 years, yet she doesn't take part in every show there. Although some theaters have resident stage managers who do manage all productions, Sabato says many companies hire different stage managers from show to show, the same way actors are cast and many other positions in a production are filled.
You want to get the right designer, you want to get the right director, the right stage manager, because it impacts on how well the end product comes together. It's a good recipe. You know, if you mix the right ingredients together, you're going to get a really good product.
Bringing the right mix of people together for a show certainly, in part, determines the success or failure of a play. But having the right stage manager in place is essential for a smoothly run production, according to Lori Agazarian, one of two stage managers at the Walnut Street Theater in Philadelphia.
In a nutshell, I am the communications hub between all the different departments that are involved in putting a production together. I'm the liaison between the designers and the director and the actors and the stagehands. It's basically making sure everybody knows everything they need to know.
While the gathering and dissemination of information helps explain the overall function of a stage manager, it doesn't adequately describe all aspects of the job. The stage manager's job starts long before performances of a show begin. The work commences with rehearsal preparation, working alongside the director to organize schedules, keeping detailed records of the direction assigned to actors and designers, compiling a list of needed props, following along in the script in case an actor needs a line prompt, making sure the actors get breaks. Another major task for a stage manager is creating a callbook, which is basically a script of the play with each technical cue of the show notated in the margins. Pat Sabato of the Arden Theater explains that considering all these responsibilities, it's entirely necessary for a stage manager to be in rehearsals from day one.
I help build a machine, and then I drive it. I'm not the one who makes the decisions about how it's going to be. But I watch how the mechanics work together so that I can maintain it.
Once the play's blueprint is locked in place and the show opens, a director's job is essentially done. At this point, the stage manager takes charge of the production. In some cases, a director may be on staff with the theater and remain around to keep an eye on the show, but often a director leaves entirely once the show is open, and maintenance of the artistic aesthetics are left to the stage manager. Here, says Pat Adams, who's been the Wilma Theater's stage manager since 1996, is where a keen understanding of a director's intentions in all areas is crucial.
To a certain extent, during the course of the run, a play can grow. It can change slightly. Sometimes growth can be in the right direction based on what you've rehearsed and what's been talked about in rehearsal. Sometimes it grows the other way. It is a stage manager's job to keep it all under control.
After opening, keeping the show running smoothly and under control extends beyond sitting in a booth and calling the show on a daily basis. It also means having interaction with the administrative staff, actors, and stage crew. For example, shortly before an Arden Theater show begins, Pat Sabato might be found backstage by the dressing rooms, chatting with stagehands and actors and keeping them posted as to how soon the audience will be seated and ready for the performance.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're at Places, please. Places. See you on the other side of the light. Have a wonderful show, guys.
Thank you,
show.
As the conduit for communication in a setting with, well, a lot of egos, it's good for a stage manager to have an abundant supply of patience, tact, and solid interpersonal skills. The Walnut Street Theater's Lori Agazarian says a thick skin is also needed, as one who needs to enforce rules and policies.
You're a cheerleader and the teacher and the disciplinarian. I mean, I have to discipline people. And at the same time, I'm handing them a Band-Aid and a Ricola and taking their used tissue out of their hand. And that's all part of my job.
Or another way to put it, according to Pat Sabato of the Arden, is that the job is a lot like parenting. She says the best training she's had for her work was being a mother.
It's a lot of the same skills. While I'm not comparing actors to children, getting people prepared to go out and do what they have to do, making sure they have everything they need and they have the right attitude for it, and building that spirit of ensemble comes from, you know, being able to keep your family running.
Though perhaps one of the less glamorous roles in a theater company, the stage manager is the lifeline for all the elements that come together in theater. In view of the complexity of the different parts, both the technical and human components, that person seated in the booth behind the audience, talking into a headset, is one manager that's indispensable.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. And that's it for now. Our program written and produced by Zavid Schlank and myself, with special thanks this week to Lawrence Saul. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore. And I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.